This show is about grassroots alternative and independent media and a critical look at our media environment. And I kind of want to break our discussion into those two halves. So grassroots alternative independent media and then critical look at our media environment. Starting with the first part, I want to talk a little bit about, for the listeners who don't know who you are, how you came to be so involved in broadcast engineering and technology and things like that. And I'm going all the way back to, you know, like the 60s and 70s and the setting up of all these non-commercial community radio stations you were involved in. Could you tell me a little bit about how you became involved in the establishment of community radio stations around the country?
I like to say these days that I was a little bit of an Asperger's kid, and like a lot of people I knew when I was younger, felt pretty estranged from society in general, and I found a lot of positive reinforcement from dinking around with wires and resistors and stuff like that when I was a kid, so that kind of got me started with technical stuff. For some reason, I got really interested in the idea of non-commercial radio when I was in high school. And I don't know how I did that, because I was in St. Louis. So I had heard somewhere that there was a radio station with no commercials. I thought, well, that's an interesting thought. And this is 1950s. So going on to getting into my life, I wound up in California as my family split up, and I volunteered at the station. That was KPFA. So that was late 50s. It was the only thing there was. Well, as time went on, I dropped out of high school, went to find a job somewhere, and naturally enough, I found a job in radio after getting an FCC first phone, which was my job ticket. And I always wanted to be a chief engineer, so that's sort of like my first job. Well, the guy hired me. He said, don't touch anything. He didn't trust me. And the second job was a kind of sleazy little AM station somewhere. And that guy said the same thing, but then when stuff broke, I fixed it, and he got to like me. So I thought this was great. And I was thinking about how important I was one day after lightning hit the transmitter and totally vaporized one of the coils in the AM transmitter. And then my mind sort of drifted over to the programming, and as I was standing there behind the transmitter feeling so important, I started thinking about the programming. I said, oh. So my story is I achieved my life goal at the age of whatever it was, 16, 18, whatever, and it's all been downhill from there.
Okay, so the first time I heard your name was when I was reading Sex and Broadcasting.
Oh, yes.
And the wacky fun times that it was going around establishing non-commercial community radio stations. How did the critical mass come together among various communities to start these community radio stations? And what was your role? I mean, you were the tinkerer. You were the one who came in and made sure the transmitter worked. Did you have any say in how these stations were actually self-organized? Or were you just kind of a traveling geek in a way?
You know, combination. The truth of the matter is that everybody thinks they can do a better job than wherever they learned. And I learned a lot later, after this job that I left. I wound up in Seattle helping to build a station called KRAB. And KRAB was the first not Pacifica listener-supported station. And it turns out that the person who started that thought he could do a better job than Lewis Hill, who had founded Pacifica. He thought he could do a better job than Lewis Hill or those who were running KPFA and soon to be BAI and KPFK at the time. So, yeah, this is sort of a long answer to your story, but every time we start one of these things, somebody thinks they can do a better job, and the angrier they get, the more likely they are to build their own station. And so I had a number of people who thought they could do a better job. Some of them left angry. Some of them were really happy. Some of them I helped. Some of them I did not. But they all started stations of their own. And so I think there are more stations than I know about or can remember. A lot of them started by ex-staff who weren't necessarily happy with what I did when I was doing my own station, because I wound up doing the same thing as everybody else. I started one in St. Louis.
Was that KDHX?
It is now.
Okay.
The successor to KDNA, which was on a commercial channel. I had thought that you could do interesting radio and make it commercial. But I guess, like Lewis Hill, who thought he could do that with Pacifica, I was wrong.
Ah, okay. And then how many stations were you involved in setting up, during that flourishing of non-commercial, non-Pacifica community radio stations?
Well, first one that comes to mind is KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. But let's see, there's the one that leaps to mind when I'm talking about people who are angry at me was a guy named Tom Connors. And I remember him leaving KDNA, shaking his fist at me, and after I think I tossed him out, I don't want to talk about why, saying, "I'll show you." And he started WRFG in Atlanta. WEFT is a station that was founded by somebody involved with KDNA. KFAI, I don't know. I remember helping a station in Omaha doing some FCC paperwork later on in my life. So, I mean, there's a bunch of them. Don't remember them all.
More than a dozen? 20? 40? Can you put a baseline number on it?
Oh, let's just guess somewhere around 10 for sure. And there's always echo effects. So, I mean, I wasn't the only one. There was Lorenzo back then, and there were stations that were that may have cropped up because they knew you could do it because we had done it, and they didn't necessarily ask me or tell me. They just said, "We can do this too if that guy can do it."
So how does How does the process of actually putting up a non-commercial community or a community radio station generally work? I mean, you obviously have to file some applications with the FCC and then go through the rigmarole of that. How frustrating was that process? Was it different for each station?
Yes, it's different. Mostly it's very, very straightforward if nobody else wants the frequency, but as time went on, the frequencies are more in demand. And if more than one party wants a frequency, then it becomes the ultimate frustration. Bureaucracy reigns. So that's the story of KDHX. And actually, that's a long and interesting story, but it took more than a decade for that station to establish itself after KDN8 switched off the air. If nobody else wants a frequency, it's really straightforward and simple, and all the religious people have figured this out years and years and years ago. Well, you found or file with your state for a not-for-profit. You have in your articles an educational goal. You can have other goals. And then you file with the Federal Communications Commission for a frequency. You have to say what the frequency is, what the power, stuff like that. The FCC has these days filing windows, so they're not very frequent, so you sort of have to keep aware. In the old days, you can file any time, but now you have to know when they're going to accept applications, and there may be just a week. And you have best, because the spectrum is now very crowded, know that you're not going to bump into anybody else who's existing. And then you cross your fingers and hope nobody else asks for the channel, and if nobody else does, it's maybe half a year, as long as you haven't made any serious errors, you'll have yourself a permit to build a new station.
And what are we talking about, like, as far as costs go? I mean, how did you manage to do this back in the day? Was it obviously pretty much on a shoestring?
Most of them were shoestring stations. The shoestring. In the 70s, you could do Class D stations, which were based on 10-watt transmitters. And part of the way to get one of these things going, if you don't have any money, and most people don't, is to go around and ask friendly radio stations and engineers they have any used equipment, and you might wind up with some. So I remember the station that's the premier, I guess, NPR affiliate now in the Monterey Bay Area, KUSP, started as a 10-watt transmitter sitting on a 55-gallon drum, something in the hallway, in the back hallway of a restaurant. And some people just got it on, got it going. That's a long time ago. And it grew from there, you know, a little bit at a time. Nowadays, you need more than 10 watts, and the engineering is likely to cost you a couple of grand. Of course, if you're in a really remote area, like I'm in Alaska now, you go to a place in Alaska where there are no signals, that's not a problem. But you need some money for the engineering studies.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Actually, and that leads to another question. You've probably heard of the Common Frequency Project, commonfrequency.org. It's a group kind of founded off of the Prometheus Radio people and other interested folks who are looking forward to the FCC opening up a filing window for full power non-commercial FM radio stations sometime in the future. They haven't exactly said when, but the word is out that this is going to be coming, and they're trying to mobilize communities to attempt to apply for these because, as you mentioned before, religious broadcasters and whatnot now know about the joys of non-commercial and commercial FM and have been snapping up frequencies left and right. Do you think that it is possible to put up stations today like it was possible to do 30 years ago? I mean, obviously, since the spectrum is more crowded, you have more potential competitors for a frequency and whatnot. But since we're dealing with non-commercial frequencies, we don't have to worry about the auction process. But is it more challenging today to go through this process and assemble the equipment and build the infrastructure than it was back then?
Yeah, short answer. But there's the rewards are much greater when Lewis Hill in 48 got KPFA first on the air. There weren't very many FM radios. By the time I got involved, and that was trying to remember, well, that was Seattle, KRAB, that had to be around 1960. It was unlikely you could find an FM radio if you wanted to buy one. They were not very common, rather expensive, and inexpensive radios were still relatively expensive and incredibly difficult to sell. I remember KRAB selling Grandcos for what probably is the equivalent of $100-$150 today. They're little table model tube radios. People would hear about the station. Now, what I'm trying to say here is that this chunk of spectrum between 88 and 108 megahertz was not thought to be desirable. It's not something that anybody wanted to do. I can remember also being in conversation with people who were knowledgeable about the broadcasting industry. Said, well, nobody's going to be interested. FM isn't going to go anywhere. It's not going to work. People don't want to hear the high-pitched tones and sound. They'll just turn the treble control down. So the signal doesn't go beyond the horizon. Blah, 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 blah. I liked FM because it did sound good as a young person. And that's obviously what's happened. That little technical advantage made AM seem obsolete some time ago, though it's still very valuable. I can remember wishing that we had an AM. In fact, Lou Hill, when he started Pacifica, had expected to be able to get an AM frequency. There were no radios. So, yeah, it's much more valuable. And because of that, it's much harder, scarcer, you know, harder to get.
Yeah, that's very true. One of the things that has kind of, I guess, resurrected some of that ethos of the heyday of building, community radio stations has been the FCC's relatively recent approval of low power FM back in 2000-2001. And as you know, the Prometheus Radio Project has been going around the country setting up stations. Weren't you just didn't you go down to Woodburn, Oregon and help with the PCUN station that just went on the air over the summer?
I didn't go there.
Oh, okay.
I was in Massachusetts.
At XLJ. Yeah. So what was it like? You are probably one of the quote-unquote old guard You know, you show up and it's like, wow, Jeremy Landsman's here. This is great. This station's going up in a jiffy. I mean, do you see a lot of analogs between what you were doing initially 30 odd years ago or more and now what's happening today with LPFM?
During the barn raisings that I've seen, there are so many people who are so good that I barely fit in. And I'll also mention that sometimes people, although I'm sure a lot of people know more than I do, there are some people who think they do and don't, but don't want to hear anything from the old guard. I felt like a little bit useless, but wandering around, I saw a lot of people busy, and you know, I just didn't push myself into it. There are a lot of smart people out there. Barn raising's a really neat idea. So somebody gets a permit for one of these things, and say, Prometheus organizes this thing, and they use it as a kind of training workshop to spread more of them. Tons of people turn out. People who don't know much want to learn. People who know a lot and go do it, and those who think they know but don't necessarily. Everybody learns. Even me.
I have. I was originally following the whole low power FM development because I was covering and involved in micro radio, unlicensed broadcasting, pirate radio, whatever you want to call it. Did you ever do any of that back in the day?
Back in the day, everybody who had technical inclinations did that. That's how they learned.
Ah.
I mean, here's what one of the people who's dead set against LPFM in our state. Involved in the Alaska Broadcasters Association, I know friends of mine who say, "Oh, that guy used to be a pirate. How could he be so anti-LPFM? How could he, you know, blah 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 blah?" Well, they forget their roots, and it's really sad. I think everybody screws around a little bit. It's easy to do. It was much harder, I guess, in the 50s and 60s, but. Oh, that's how we learned. But you know what's interesting is that, I guess to me, is that unlicensed, I call it undocumented broadcasting, is not a technical matter for some people because the equipment is much more readily available, much more portable, and a lot less expensive than it was in the 50s and 60s. My first pirate FM broadcast transmitter I made by hand. It took me probably half a year. And it involved a bunch of tubes, and it was the first thing they made, actually, from some ground up with that actually worked.
Wow.
I knew somebody with an FM radio a block away, and I could hear it. I said, well, that's kind of cool. Because there were no, I think we had one station in the town at the time.
Wow.
On FM, so who's going to notice except me?
That's right. It's over the years, I guess, undocumented broadcasting has become, as you said, like a little less technical to achieve, but slightly more political to undertake. I mean, most people that get involved in doing that type of radio now are doing it explicitly to make a statement about the FCC's spectrum regulation policies and the fact that that the allocation rules do not really reflect the technical reality on the ground, i.e. you can put more stations on the dial than you could years ago because receiver sensitivity is better, transmitters are tighter and things like that. Do you see there still being a positive justification for continuing to do undocumented broadcasting in that political in the political aspect today?
You're asking me.
It's supposed to be a softball question, but
it's a tough one actually. So I always go get licenses, and I don't think it's. I mean, I say that kind of cavalierly, but I mean, part of what I've been talking about for a while is that FM's far more popular when. I got licenses, and a lot of these stations sprang up. It wasn't. It wasn't the where you wanted to be was AM. And so there's part of me that says, okay, well, all these people want to be in the band. First of all, a lot of them, you go look at the enforcement to see where people are busted for running these things, or at least they get the notice of unlicensed operation. You go to the FCC website. It's FCC.gov/EB. and you go look, there's a list of them, and they're in big cities. Well, look where I am. I'm in Anchorage. Why am I in Anchorage? Well, because there was a Channel 5 available here. People ask me, why did you come to Alaska to build a TV station? Well, I would have gone to New York, but Channel 5 was taken there. And, you know, part of me says, well, these people who want to make these statements, they're doing it where it's least needed. And part of me gets kind of angry about that. I'm thinking, okay, there may be a number of unlicensed operators that have a political agenda. There are more of them that don't. And just want to play music, and they think that's fun. And I don't think it serves any purpose. So, but there's another part of me that sees a long line of civil disobedience as being an important tool of political change, in the role of Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi. And so, you know, you touch me and the conflicts will come out. I don't know where to go with this.
Gotcha. Well, that makes sense. I mean, as you said, as a licensed operator, you went to where the opportunities were, and that's the way,
well,
it plays out.
So look, I operated a truly free speech radio station, and by truly, I mean we had all political viewpoints represented on the air. And we had a rule at our station. This is 1968 to 74. Anybody who wanted to get on the air was, by our own rule, 15 minutes, no questions asked. Say anything you want, as long as it didn't have gratuitous foul language. And people availed themselves of that, and it was sometimes pretty interesting, and more often not. But the point is that we provided that, and it was a huge struggle, you know, in the middle of the country during the Vietnam War. It was so much easier to be on the coast, one or the other. Oh, where are the difficult times? I see a lot of the people who see, anti-totalitarian types like me wind up in the easy places where there are a lot of people of like mind. That doesn't serve us as a nation, I think, as much as going out and being a missionary for a while in the distant reaches. I don't know.
Okay. Skipping forward now to how you got to Alaska. You said you ended up there because you wanted to set up a TV station, and that's where Channel 5 was. So you established KYES, right, in Anchorage.
Yep.
When did you start that station, and why did you decide to start that station?
Oh, for me, the why was, gee, you could make some money doing it. I've been doing all this stuff for no money for so long, and I need a retirement plan.
What was it like to make the jump between radio and TV?
Oh, technically, it's much more challenging to have pictures, but it's not that much more challenging. I think what I learned, I started out in with KBDI, which is in the Denver market. And I think much more challenging that people just don't really grasp who aren't in the business is the copyright issues. You can't go down to Blockbuster and rent a bunch of movies and just go play them. You can go to the library and check out a bunch of records and play them on the radio. So what a difference. Whoa. It's the economic model that's different. What you haven't touched on with me yet is, how is it working in the age of consolidation? And that's, I could be burning with rage about that. It's kind of interesting.
Well, what do you, you asked your own question.
Yeah.
What is it like operating a television station, an independent television station, in an age of consolidation?
Well, the TV station is an affiliate of something. When WB started, we had WB and UPN on. Those got taken away from us, one and then the other. First one, because Warner Brothers decided that small markets were too small to bother with, so they're going to put everything on cable and with a little box of play stuff all day. And then UPN decided to merge. So now they merged to become CW. I can't even think. I don't want to think of it. Rupert Murdoch's new network.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Irony of ironies.
Well, it's 2 hours a day. So, you know, what is it like? It's like being a pea that's still floating on a rough sea, bouncing around, and all the big waves are being made by the big players. And I can't imagine how come we are still here. What I do know is that there are very few single station owner operators left in the United States. It may be that KYES and Jeremy and his wife, Carol, are the only ones left pretty soon. We've heard there's one other. And I'll tell you what, it's not very nice. It was a big change in this business when they decided to allow the networks to own the programs.
Because then that
syndication
sucked up the programming a pond that you could actually draw from.
Yeah.
Wow. So how do you manage it? I mean, is it scraping by day-to-day living pretty much? Not so much of a retirement plan? I mean,
you've invested
in the infrastructure to a certain degree.
Basically, it feels like we are, I think I'm a slave to Hollywood. That's it. We are in an Anchorage, there's not very much interest in consolidating somebody coming in buying the fifth ranking station in a market with 310,000 households where there are six commercial TV stations. You see, there's lots of spectrum here.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an interesting problem. And, you know, it's got its advantages. So.
Also, to steer the conversation to something a little bit more fun and positive. You're still doing a lot of that wonderful tinkering, and you are also still doing a lot of that wonderful tweaking of the FCC regulations in order to put new stations on the air. I wanted to ask you a little bit about a couple of the projects you've been involved in the last few years. The first one being successfully hacking DTV and putting up a DTV signal pretty much on a super shoestring with KYES. How did that come about, and how did you manage to do that, and is it still on the air now?
Oh, it came about because the FCC mandated that all commercial stations have a DTV signal. At the time I did this, I was facing extension of my permit to construct. And each time you do it, you get 6 months. You send this application into the FCC, and you wait to see. And they said, well, third one. And they're really tough. And that's because there is generally a kind of agreement among a lot of people that this was a multi-billion-dollar giveaway to the commercial TV interests, giving everybody a second channel. Well, you know, I had mine, and some channel that got assigned, and here I am. I think it was the second renewal. I'm looking at it, and I thought, I wonder if I could actually build this, because once you get something on, you don't have to ask for an extension of the permit to construct. And they were threatening the third one that was your last at the FCC at the time. Oh, okay. Well, I looked on eBay, and there was stuff. First, there was an exciter. I said, oh. And then the cable guys gave me an encoder, and some other things came along. I guess there was HDNet at the time, I remember, was there. That was kind of, and they said I could use the programming from that. So I had the stuff to put a signal on. The power amp was an old analog TV translator, 100 watts. So I cobbled it together, and it worked. That was what was really shocking. And stuff worked. And I had an HDTV signal on when nobody else was broadcasting in Anchorage.
How far ahead of the rest of the Anchorage market did you beat them by?
About a year.
Wow. Of course, nobody was watching because there weren't HDTVs, right?
Well, yeah. You know, what's more interesting is that, to me, it felt like FM in the 50s. And it still does, but for a different reason now. There were a few people who called up and they said, like they'd say, are you interested? Are you going to do digital TV? And I'd say, I'm on the air. Or I'd get an email. And then I remember there were a couple of them pretty technical, and one of them had a PC adapter card for receiving the signals, and he'd call me up regularly, and we'd talk, oh, yeah, I've seen this and that. And so on the other hand, yeah, there are a lot of HDTV sets being sold now, but nobody knows to use an antenna. And since they hook up to cable, well, it's DTV signal, it's not cable. So it's the same. There are no viewers.
Right. Right.
There are no listeners. But what's interesting about it, jumping ahead, is that out of the 19.7 megabits a second that we get, adding audio, lots of audio streams, is really easy. And so early on I did that. I discovered that you could send incredibly good quality. And so I set up a music stream. I became compulsive, and I checked out records from the library for months and built up a library of about, 13,000, I think, items, and encoded, put them on hard disk and encoded them with lossless encoding, set up a digital link. It's all digital. I believe it's the highest quality digital sound broadcast in probably North and South America, but for sure North America. But I'm the only listener, so there you go.
So you were doing digital radio before digital radio was even cool or even really thought of.
Well, I think
except
it was
on TV.
iBox was thought of, but it's I was doing it early, yeah, before anybody else got on the air, I do believe. Although the radio is part really a transport stream on TV. I was just telling somebody about this. If you look at Freeview in the UK, which is the terrestrial digital system that's free, it has a lot of radio services on it, but I have found very few, or I've heard of one or two digital TV stations that include an audio service. And it's so not thought of that the FCC has all these rules about children's programming and whatnot, and that there's nothing in there about sound.
Interesting. I did not know that. To slightly change topics on you again, because I'm trying to run through my laundry list of things I've always wanted to ask you.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Oh, laundry list.
It's a long list.
Let's be sure we get this done.
Next up, the vegetables. KZND, the end. This is another interesting, I think, somewhat unprecedented escapade involving a TV station masquerading as a radio station. Now, to give the backstory here, you and I guess a partner, did you say, applied for the license for Channel 6 in Anchorage as well?
No, I applied for it originally to supplement the service of Channel 5.
Okay.
That and a UHF, and I got both.
Okay.
So you had both. I chose to put one on the air as TV.
Right. So then you had this Channel 6 TV license, but you decided since Channel 6 audio is receivable at, 87.75 on your FM dial, why not just run it as a radio station? So it started out as a audio only. And it was The End, which was a commercial alternative or something
like
that?
Yeah, well, there were partners involved in that who came to me and said, we'd like to do a commercial radio station on this. And I thought, okay. And we batted it around a little bit and thought it might make money, but like most things didn't work out that way. But anyway, they started up a commercial format. It was very fun. There were some amusing parts of it. It was very current, I guess, rock is the specialty of the format. The End is a recognized format. The people were walking around town with clapboards that said, The End is here. So the promotion was fun. But, yeah, and the FCC got quite upset.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't just the FCC that got quite upset. Apparently, it was other commercial broadcasters in Anchorage who thought that you were somehow being screwball with the rules, but you weren't, because the FCC rules allow you to run the video and audio segments of a TV channel independently, right?
Well, in English, if you go look at the rule, it says, yeah, exactly as you quoted. You can run them independently. It doesn't elaborate very much on that. And there's some history there, which I won't go into right now. It would be too lengthy for your radio program. But anyway, this started up, and I gather that some of the commercial people got very upset. So the first thing that happened that was significant is they convinced Arbitron not to rate it. that was very significant in our dollar life. The next thing is local FCC people called up Marlene. I like Marlene and Dave. They call up. Marlene says, you don't have a license for an FM station. And I said, Marlene, I do. It says audio at this frequency, 87.74 megahertz, FM. I have a license. She said, and we went back and forth about this, and we didn't, I mean, I'm just saying, and then I used the same argument about it being illegal to run them independently. I didn't have the video on. Well, next thing happens is Hossein, who's in charge of the branch at the FCC that does LPTV, calls up, and he says the same thing, and I make the same reply. And then at the end he was saying, of the conversation, he was saying, well, you can't announce yourself or publicize yourself as an FM station. And I said, Hossein, I think it's time I call an attorney. We'll be talking later, but nice talking to you. Bye. A lot of, I think, the trouble was a commercial broadcaster in town who was more a carpetbagger. He's out of San Francisco. He's passed away now. Chester Coleman. And Chester filed a complaint with enforcement and the media bureau, and the complaint said pretty much what he had to say about the we're not following the rules and this and that. So, you know, it got kind of toasty for a little while. He said that, I remember, he claimed that there's no way well, this could be legitimate because we never had the money to put a picture on the air. So I went up to the transmitter site with a camera. I put on the wall a little piece of paper, 8.5 by 11, and I said, if you see this call and a phone number, local phone number that I had forwarded, I had call forwarded to the attorney that filed this complaint. And I threw the transmitter on for the picture, and the next thing I know is I get served a copy of the new complaint to enforcement saying that he got over 200 phone calls. And I said, well, there you go. I guess I can do a picture.
That's great.
I enjoyed it.
So
I figured I'd win. So
the station, though, no longer exists, correct? I mean, the programming has been moved to another frequency, but what's happening on Channel 6 now?
Well, Channel 6 is still duplicating the programming on another frequency. So economically, it didn't work. To make it work, you had to have something Arbitron would rate. So they won. They won with Arbitron, not the FCC. And who knows? I mean, it might have made money had they not done that. But in any event, by agreement, the format has been sort of given over with some of the assets to another broadcaster who... It's kind of a long story, but anyway, it's simulcasting at the moment, and pretty soon the 87.7's got to go away anyway, for other reasons.
These are not the only projects you've been involved in. I know that you have worked to establish some non-commercial educational radio stations in Anchorage and one other place, KWMD, and what's the other one? I can't remember. What's the story behind those, and do you have plans for those at this stage? How do you find time to keep proliferating signals like this?
Well, can I wind up the last topic for some moment?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's some other LPTV people have gone and established New York City 87.7 Channel 6 and another one in L.A., and I hear there's a project underway in Chicago. And they're making tons of money, and I'm jealous. So there's the end of that story.
Wow.
People could have done it in other places. It's not quite FM because not every FM radio can get it. So there's the end of that topic.
Yeah, well...
But if you go to New York City, I think you'll hear Russian programming on 87.7.
Yeah, well, you know, the pioneers always get the shaft.
Yep. Yep, it's quite the shaft. So then there's... KWMD, Alaska's Weapon of Mass Discussion, and soon to be KABN FM. So there was a full service window in 2000, and a friend of mine filed for those and asked me if I'd be on the board of the not-for-profit They are located in Kisilov, Alaska. I added two of them, and there's a third in Sterling. So he filed for them thinking he was going to get rich, and that didn't work out. So I wound up building it and putting together a computer and putting together a schedule, and people are beginning to listen now. It went on the air a year ago. And yeah, I go on the computer and I kind of keep doing stuff. Hopefully we'll get some volunteers and figure out. Well, we've been very lucky. It's been very inexpensive to run, so I've been able to afford it so far. Two signals, one of which gets into Anchorage via a translator. There was also a translator window, and a handful of those got granted. So got to build some translators that serve the Anchorage region.
Okay. You mentioned that you'd gotten into the business of broadcasting partially for business reasons, and that you were hoping to make a living off of it and set up a retirement and enjoy a nice life doing things that you love.
Well, I had heard that having a VHF TV station is a license to print money. Hadn't you heard that?
Yeah.
Okay. So. It hasn't worked out, I guess, the way you would have hoped. It's been a constant struggle.
Yep.
So, what would you say to people who are interested in getting on the air and setting up stations today for that type of reason? Is the opportunity pretty much gone, and you're just consigning yourself to a life of beating your head against a wall, or what?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. What I'm thinking about is, you do a commercial radio station, there may be places where you can do really well still as an independent owner-operator, but you're competing with the big guys. And that's the telecom, 96 Telecom Act, and the consolidation has made it much tougher for the independents, I think. The other guys here in Anchorage in the TV business, they're losing money too often. I mean, I can't really be specific because they don't show me their books, but I know that when the Fox affiliate and the CBS affiliate wanted to merge, that I petitioned to deny, but their merger request was based on because you can't still merge the top four, and they were in the top four. They both claimed that they're financially distressed and losing money, and they swore it, and statements to the FCC under oath, but they're all owned by outside entities. So if they lose money, it's no big deal, I guess. It's harder for us.
Well, what is it that keeps you going? What is it that keeps you continuing to do what it is you're doing? Not only running the TV station, but all of these other projects. How do you manage to do that? Not only fiscally, but just emotionally, and keep yourself in a frame of mind that allows you to be healthy and keep living on borrowed time, as you put it once.
Well, it's not to be too wrapped up in it, because there are other things in life, and as long as we're alive, we should be pretty happy with the wonderful things we have, most of us in this country. So I'm not... I'm not going to kill myself over this. And whatever it is, it is.
Well, that was a nice short answer.
Yeah, well, we've already run out of time three times over.
No, you caught me in mid swig with my Coke bottle. That was the problem.
I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I know we've run over, and I'm going to have to edit this down, but I still wanted to ask you a little bit about the part two thing. A critical look at our media environment, and this is going to specifically deal with. And like I said, all of this stuff is going up.
Well, this is your topic.
This is all going up on the website anyway. So
it's your topic. So it is. Incredibly, I think it's incredibly important, but I think it goes way beyond broadcasting.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to move to now, is that you've been doing a lot of work, and you've mentioned this throughout our conversation about how, the computerization, the internet, the wonderful ways you can get programming and schedule things to play and not have to spend all of your time thinking about the programming aspect of this, and earlier this weekend you were you're messing with all your asterisk phone server stuff and all that. You've really kind of gone in that direction and are really exploring that side of the media environment. And it's very good, obviously. It has its positives, but there are also a lot of regulatory potential regulatory hurdles that we're looking at being developed right now with things like the internet network neutrality, control over the last mile, access to the larger network. What are your thoughts on some of that and how do you see some of these very critical battles playing out in the near future? Do you keep track of that kind of stuff?
The internet is incredible. It's just incredible. So now, it's possible for one person part-time to run two radio stations with computers. One of my dreams, so I'm going to try to answer in little segments. One of my dreams from the 70s, early 70s, was to have all the world's music on one big machine wherein you could select the music to play one thing after the other so that it's kind of fit together in some way. Well, now you can put all the music on a hard drive and you've got search tools and there's gizmos, software gizmos that'll find things that match in terms of tempo and key and mood. I mean, all this stuff is there and programming is out on the internet. So unlike the early days where you had to do it yourself get it mailed to you or get it on a regular dial-up phone line, like I remember Winter Soldier was a phone remote. We had phone remotes back then. You now have the internet, which is just an incredible tool. And in fact, the radio station is sort of like the dog being wagged by the tail, but soon the tail is going to be bigger than the dog if things keep going the way they are. The only reason that the internet is not replacing FM totally is you don't have internet in the car.
Yeah,
I'd love to have a car radio that's sort of like a car radio, but really can tune in stuff. So, yeah, this is great. But does net neutrality threaten that? It sure does. And I don't think it, well, I guess service providers, ISPs, could block anything they want if there's no net neutrality, as long as the customers don't rise up. And if there's enough competition, they can squelch whatever they want. That's a little scary because this period of incredible freedom is would end. The bulk of the public's going to want to still go to the same old media sites, the Hollywood sites, the CNNs, the ABCs. That's always going to be the case because it's entertainment driven. People want to be entertained. So this is sort of like topic two. But there's an incredible amount of force on the other side that's from the provider's side that says we don't want to have certain things competing with us. So you may shoot movies and put them on the internet, but could be that any movie download you want to do. See, that'll get cut off if some company puts a lot of movies for you to download for a fee, and it competes with the same ISP's cable operation. That ISP will say, well, this is competing with us, so why should we pay to let you compete with us? People are watching TV on the internet now. And the business that I'm in, commercial TV, what if you get the same shows on the internet?
Yeah, and Google just bought YouTube.
Well, it's getting worse. The networks are putting TV shows on the internet. For me, that's a threat. The commercial TV business, and a serious one, but worse, it's a threat to the ISP if they're also in the cable TV business. Think about that.
Yeah, that's true.
And voice over internet, what if they're in the telephone business? I think there's a company called AT&T that does both cable and telephone, right? Don't they have a reason to not pass along video and telephone to subscribers? So, I mean, I don't know exactly how it's going to work out. That the internet's just a wonderful field of vigorous creativity.
To, I guess, kind of play out a little bit more with the idea of infrastructure. You brought up the fact that the reason why, you know, streaming audio on the internet is not bigger than FM right now is because we don't have ubiquitous wireless broadband connectivity yet. We don't even have ubiquitous broadband connectivity yet, much less wireless. And there's been some interesting, you know, I guess proposals, not really anything formal, but discussion topics that have come up. And there's been two of them that, at least in DC world, which I tend to live in more often than I like to, two potential concepts for bringing us toward that idea of ubiquity. The first one is to treat the build out of broadband networks akin to rural electrification. You know, if large telecom companies are not willing to actually lay fiber into the ground to provide the kind of fat pipes that we're going to need to do all these wonderful things, then maybe the government or some other not-for-profit or organization or whatever should step in and actually start to build that alternate infrastructure or a new infrastructure. And we're starting to see things like SBC, AT&T, and Viacom, Verizon, investing in that kind of stuff. But of course, they're targeting high-income neighborhoods. They're not pressing towards the idea of universal service or ubiquity that we see from the phone system. And then the other component to that infrastructure build-out that I think is really interesting that people are talking about, and if you haven't read about this, this is something good to check up on, is the New America Foundation's Jim Snyder does a lot of work on spectrum policy issues. And there's been talk, at least at the FCC level, of reappropriating analog television channels once the DTV switchover is done for use as unlicensed wireless spectrum.
Yeah, I do know about that.
And those two components together, the actual build out of a fiber optic backbone network that is somewhat publicly controlled, coupled with, or maybe supplemented by, rather, Wi-Fi or wireless access by appropriating spectrum that has been traditionally used for something else, could start to solve these problems. But the problem where I hang up in all these wonderful utopian ideas is then you're just combining special interest forces against you. You're not just taking on the broadcasters who want to keep that spectrum and repurpose it for other things. You're also going to take on the telecom companies who don't want to even have alternate infrastructures built. So, I mean, these are all wonderful ideas. Do you have have you thought through a pie in the sky way to bring us to the point where we can have ubiquitous broadband similar to the way we see like AM, FM, and TV?
Smart radios are really going to be interesting in the future, but let me focus on the unused television spectrum first, because I'm most familiar with that. It's an incredible threat to the technical coverage of our TV station, as is BPL, by the way, on Channel 5, because it goes into Channel 5. That's the channel that the digital will wind up on, by the way. According to what I filed with the FCC. Now, the question is, will anybody be watching it? Does it have any utility? That's my personal issue. But let's assume that people are going to want to watch it, that you want to have the technical coverage of the TV station. And this is a big deal. If you take this all the TV channels, 2 through, I think it's going to be 51 when the transition's over from analog to digital TV, and you look for the places between stations that's 6 megahertz wide TV channels are available, there's going to be tons of it. There'll be a lot more available and unused than is used. So going with the plan that says, go ahead and forget Jeremy and his interference question, go ahead and you can have a wireless access point, and you can just turn it on and have up to 20 watts of ERP or 1 watt of transmitter, which, by the way, is the limit right now on 802.11b. It's you can just go huge distances with this stuff with proper antennas and whatnot. You know, in communities where Wi-Fi is kind of flourishing, where people are interconnecting, that provides a distributed ownership model. And that's pretty interesting. So there's heck, if I'm so concerned about interference, well, I could just put up my own Wi-Fi points under these new rules that would interfere with my own signal and put my TV station on it. Well, you know, how it would really play out is an interesting question. I have a technical solution to the interference, which is that every access point and every user, actually, I thought, well, everybody who receives digital TV, because you can't really tell the interference, could be aware of the internet, wireless internet in the same TV spectrum, and tell the access points that it's watching this channel. So when you're watching channel 45, it would tell all the access points in your neighborhood that you're watching channel 45 and please stay off. And that would solve the problems. Every TV set would have an access point, and it would tell the other access points via common channel, common signaling, that that channel is in use. And when that TV set goes off, let's say you're in a rural area and you're the only house for a mile, when you turn your TV set off, then suddenly a channel 45 becomes available for wireless. That would be kind of cool, huh?
Yeah, but that's...
But you'd just tell everybody else what you're tuned to at that moment.
Yeah, but that's like one of those, I mean, it's almost like, it seems to me like the FCC is going ahead with trying to promulgate rules without looking through all the possible technical solutions.
Well, I don't think anybody had thought of this idea. I emailed it off to someone and I said, well, it requires a lot of development for the specifics, but I'm not going to take the time unless somebody gets back to me, I guess. But it could be, the protocols could be worked out for that. No, nobody at the FCC is going to do this. They respond to lobbying pressures. And those pressures, I think, are really good in terms of liberating spectrum for the use of Internet. So I think there should be a way to accommodate both uses. And that would be very helpful. Then the next thing is looking down the road 20, 30 years, maybe not that long, there are these theories about having the wireless access that, I mean, everywhere I go now, just about everywhere, I can find with my laptop a wireless access point in a lot of places. I don't mean in Anchorage, I mean all over the country. I can get my email and stuff without paying anybody. I mean, that's really nice. And if everybody had a way of commonly doing this and having little micro charges that pass around, well, that's an idea I read in Scientific American a few issues back. And so whatever spectrum is in use, you can tap into it, and you just have to pay back by providing access to somebody else, or you wind up paying in dollars at the end. So that, you know, there could be ways of doing this.
Okay, like karmic micropayments.
Yeah.
Karmic micropayments. I like that idea.
Yeah. Well, there are people thinking about that and working on it, so it's nice to know, because if, as long as the entire ability, as long as the industry of communications can stay distributed, it's going to be incredibly liberating. If it becomes consolidated into a few major companies that control everything, forget it. I say this as a person who is never too fond of Ma Bell. And I know a lot of people were and still are. There are friends of mine who actually, one I talked to a few days ago, who, you know, in a way would like to go back to the days when you paid a buck a minute for long distance. And he just said that. He said, well, it would be probably 30 or 40 cents a minute.
Yeah, but you can't even own your own phone.
Well, it's hard to remember those days. For those of you, those who are younger, they don't know about that. But the innovation that we've had in telecom is brought about through the ability of innovators to be able to generate new things, and the internet provides that in the creative area as well. It's not just products, but it's also ideas, and ideas are far more important in the long term to the survival of America as hopefully as a democracy.
Getting to that point specifically, because we did touch on that before when we talked this weekend, I sense pessimism from you when it comes to the future of American democracy, and looking at the trends in both broadcasting and in telecommunications, where we are seeing consolidation, especially at the infrastructure level, the critical, you know, access and control level, are you in any sense optimistic that we can continue to keep at least some sort of distributed communications medium alive through all of these sea changes that we're going through right now, even though there are these wonderful potential technological partially technological solutions to them?
Obviously, if government's able to buy fiat, decide what's permissible. I mean, no. I mean, if they can come pick you up and lock you away because as many countries is the case, because of something you've said that the government on a whim decides they don't like, it doesn't matter what the technology is or how free it is to use. You're not free to use it. And I'm just flabbergasted by the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which essentially gives the government the right to pick you up and lock you away, and may, depending on how it's implemented and what the courts have to say about it, give them that right to claim, they can just claim you're not a citizen, and then you have no recourse. You have no right. It could be that you could be picked up and disappeared, and nobody would be told that that has happened to you or where you are. So your friends might report you as a missing person, and that'd be it. Some people should be very upset about this besides me, and there are a few. I'm very upset, but we'll see. I feel the same way I did when my father died. I'm grieving. I can't believe Congress did this. I can believe that my senators, who are Republicans, and my representative, Don Young, would do this because it's marching orders from the top, but that nobody stood up to decry this just astounds me, and to delay the process. Yep, they had to come home.
Well,
absolutely flabbergasted that the tool will be in the executive's hands to handle us the way the Chinese the communist Chinese government handles the Chinese and the Tibetans. I hope I'm wrong.
So what is it that makes you get out of bed every day and keep doing what you're doing, other than the need to pay the bills and keep the signals on the air, given that it is such a bleak outlook for the future of democratic communication in many ways?
I don't think it's bleak as long as we're free to speak, as long as we aren't locked away. I mean, to make it legal. People have been doing stuff that was illegal for a long time in government to suppress speech. There's no question about it. What's new would be to make it legal. And that's scary, but, you know, we're still here. So I'm hopeful as well as scared. A little bit.
At least for now.
Depressed.
10 years from now, will you still be running TV and radio stations?
Yeah, it looks like. Unless you know somebody who wants to buy a TV station in Anchorage.
Well, I
might take off for a long vacation somewhere.
You know, running a voiceover IP service, setting up, some sort of ISP that, anything like that. Have you tinkered in that direction at all?
Oh, yeah. So how did I get involved in this? Let's see. Our T1 service with the telephone on it was flaky on and off. It started out, we had a week of no service at our TV station a year and a half or so ago. And I was also paying for the FM station on the peninsula, $30 a month for a POTS phone, regular old phone. So I thought, well, I got two different incentives to, why can't I get Vonage here? Vonage is this VOIP service where they charge you, $25 a month or something for all the long distance you can eat. But they don't have any Alaska phone numbers. So, I guess I better start my own. So I looked into that, and I have had one running at my house for quite a while just to learn how. And I've had one running at the station, and it is, we are talking through it. It's not gone commercial. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. But, what if I did this? Well, I'm basically reselling bits on an AT&T internet pipe. They come from somewhere else, and my T1 connection to the public switch telephone network is provided by one of the two major telcos here in Anchorage. So I become somebody who is reselling a retail product. It's getting rich on that. Sounds like a slim chance, but oh well. Maybe I'll go public and start selling the service. So if you want to have a, John, do you want to have an Anchorage phone number?
Yeah, why not? I'm still trying to get on the whole voice over IP bandwagon. I'm so far behind, and that's not even funny. But I'm definitely going to do it now because you've convinced me that you're right. It is part of what I do, and it is something that I do need to learn. So, you know, I don't even have an iPod, for Christ's sakes. I'm trying. I just started text messaging on my cell phone. I didn't even really have a cell phone until a couple of years ago. So I'm really like fighting technology in a lot of ways. And I know I shouldn't be doing that, but.
Well, I didn't like text messaging because of my thumbs having to push the little buttons.
Yeah.
And then I will like it even less because I know that the communications theory here, you're sending basically bits. Each character is 8 bits that you hit on the keypad, and you're limited with text messages to 256 characters, I think. But when you're talking, you're sending 8 kilobits per second or so, depending on the way the audio is compressed. And so it's much cheaper for the cell phone companies to transmit and deliver a text message than voice. But they charge us 10 cents to send and 10 cents to receive a text message.
Right.
How can they do that?
Profit margins.
Because people are willing to pay. That's ridiculous. They should pay me to use text messaging.
Right.
Bastards.
Well, that's a whole other can of worms. People are saying, like, to go back to the whole net neutrality thing, if you want to look at a non-neutral network, basically look at the cell phone networks where everything is already metered. Terms of service explicitly deny you from using other protocols that are not approved by your carrier and all this other crazy stuff. And the funny thing is people, because it fits in the palm of their hand, are willing to accept it. And because it is an incrementally charged system in a lot of ways.
Well, it's mobile.
They seem to be willing to accept it. But I mean,
it's mobile and it's been around since when? The early 80s? Mid 80s, it really got started, I guess. So it's been around a lot longer in the public's hands than the internet. Mobile phones, yeah, pretty handy. I just think, yeah, you're right, that the segregation of the billing model, the way that they recover their costs is by segregating. Now, the thing is that they're already doing that in cable TV, because when you get a cable modem, you're using the cable bandwidth part for internet, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And it's part for TV. And maybe it's part for some other things they have on there that you don't know about.
Yeah.
And so they're taking that bandwidth and slicing it up different ways and selling it, getting revenue out of it. Now, everybody just makes money. That's how you eat and pay your employees when you have employees, et cetera. You've got to do that. So what they're looking in the net neutrality argument is to not have it neutral so they can slice and dice it more ways. So I think that's something to consider. But the other thing to consider is they're already doing it. So maybe you, regulatory-wise, it's, it's a tough one. And can I talk? I mean, I sat down with the guys who run the cable system here in this town, and they feel very threatened. It's there. It's real. It's very real. Suddenly, their cable TV business is reduced in value because people deliver television over their internet, which is on their cable, competing with their cable business. They're also in the phone business. People are beginning to deliver telephone over the same cable. These are their core businesses. And if you are in their position in Anchorage, I mean, these are not big telcos. In Anchorage, it's a little company, and I know the guys who run it. I don't know the members of the board, I guess, but you know, it's a multi-million-dollar company, and it's big, but compared to me. But
yeah,
well, I understand their pain. Now, how to resolve that's fair, that's something that that I haven't really approached in my thinking, but. And I know how it's really resolved. You know.
Yeah.
People go to Washington and they and they describe the internet as a series of tubes.
Right. Well, it was interesting in one of those Senate hearings talking about net neutrality and things like that. One of the, I can't remember who it was, maybe it was Rockefeller, said it is easier to implement regulations that at least give some sort of semblance of direction to the implementation of business models than it is to rescind a business model once it's already implemented. You know what I mean? Like, it's easier to at least lay down some ground rules that say non-discrimination is the status quo except for these specific quality of service, you know, provisions, than it is to say we're not going to regulate anything, let the marketplace decide, and then if there is a problem, we will intervene. So it's almost like, and you know, the other problem is that the whole discourse has been boiled down to sound bites that are overly simplistic. But I would rather fall on the side of having ground rules laid down that everybody could refer to, with the government already being proactive about it, than just to wait and say, let's wait until a problem develops and then we'll figure out if we can do something about it. Because I can't see the Justice Department intervening in this. I just did a conference call with voice over IP, my first voice over IP conference call chat thing through some plugin service. I didn't even have to use Skype or whatnot. It was all through my browser. With Bill Moyers, who's doing a PBS special, The Net at Risk. It's coming out next Wednesday. It's going to air next Wednesday. And, you know, he was talking about how he talked with the folks who have set up the AstroTurf front groups, Hands Off the Internet and things like that. And they got them to admit on tape, Mike McCurry, former spokesman for Bill Clinton, saying, yeah, well, we'll say that, you know, there's no problem. Let's wait for a problem to develop and then the government can handle it. But this administration's not going to intervene if somebody decides to start blocking traffic. They're just not going to do it. And I don't really have a lot of faith in the idea that there can be a public outcry large enough to actually force the government to do anything. But part of me really thinks the system is too far gone to even make intervention something worth trying to waste your time on. But that's just my own internal contradictions coming out.
Are you that if ISP says I'm going to block all of, let's say, Vonage's calls, that's not very likely to get the regulators in to say you can't do that?
Well, the FCC has tackled that problem once, and that was involving, Madison River Communications, some little small place in North Carolina, I think. The FCC,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the FCC has already, shortly, actually, the FCC will be implementing a net neutrality task force. And, you know, task forces are where important issues go to die in a lot of ways, so that they can say that they're looking over the problem and they're talking about it. Now, if there was, some sort of discrimination case that came up tomorrow, would the FCC jump on it? Maybe, because the political heat over this particular issue is high enough that they know they're going to get swamped by the Save the Internet Coalition and things like that. But let's say that we get past the November elections, we make it through the lame duck Congress, Telecom Act is reviewed, there are no provisions for network neutrality put in. Come next November, the conditions on all the mergers go away. And if Verizon decided to start blocking Vonage at that point, would the FCC intervene? Maybe, maybe not. Would the Justice Department intervene? Which is one of the things that a lot of the folks who don't necessarily oppose network neutrality on pure principle grounds, but just oppose it on the idea that we don't want to preemptively regulate. They'll say, well, that might be an antitrust issue. Maybe the Department of Justice would get involved. And I think that's
well,
the context.
Antitrust in this administration,
right,
and previous ones has not been vigorously enforced. So,
right,
in fact, quite the reverse. And I do know something about that. So it's possible, but unlikely.
So you got the FCC possibly that can intervene, and you have the DOJ that can possibly intervene, and
you could have private parties sue on antitrust claims, but it goes to the same courts, which have been more hands-off as of recently on antitrust. So the prospects for an antitrust claim aren't as good as they might have been in the past.
Right, and if you decide,
in general,
if you decide to challenge, like, you know, say to file some sort of litigation to try to get the FCC to move on something like that, you're going to end up in the D.C. circuit, and they're really friendly to the FCC.
Well, the FCC is not a place to go for antitrust. I don't think.
Right. I'm just saying, like, as a, but if that was a one, if that was the other angle that you wanted to try to attack a discrimination case by forcing the FCC to move in that direction.
Well, let me go back to this thing. We're just going to have a wide-ranging discussion here for a minute. Let me imagine, and this is why I say I don't really have a good answer, but I haven't been thinking about it. I've been thinking about getting my asterisk VOIP phone to work instead, Astra with asterisk. The last couple of days. Now, let's say you're the owner of a cable company, and you're the main ISP in your community, and you deliver cable TV via the old-fashioned. You have some channels that are analog. You have a lot of channels that are digital. You have cable modems, so you're delivering internet service to people's homes. And let's say you're a you've been providing local dial tone to people, so you're competing with local phone service, and you've begun to do that over your cable system. And I'm describing what we have here in Anchorage. So it's not the only ISP, but it's a major one. It's the biggest. Now, let's say that you make a plant change. Let's just make the argument simpler and easier to comprehend. So you're as is being done in many places, your cable television transmission is via TCP/IP. Well, suddenly, everything on your cable is bits, indistinguishable from other bits. Right now, maybe two-thirds of your plant is taken up with ordinary cable TV type services like Food Network or Sci-Fi Network, and a third is split mostly with internet, but a chunk of it to those dial tone customers that are now on the cable plant rather than using copper. But who can tell the difference? What are the rules going to be? And if you say net neutrality, what does that mean? You've already, two-thirds of the plant is used for something that's dedicated, that is not neutral, and has priority. That's your cable TV. There's no contention for space in those bits. The internet is built on a contention system where everybody gets an equal chance. That's your net neutrality. But when I go in to talk to you on the phone, a regular internet, voice over internet thing, my bits to speak to you are contending with all the other bits. When I talk to you on a regular telephone system, switch network, public switch network, I have a dedicated path, 64 kilobits a second, that I'm talking to you on right now. And you've got to, if you're giving me voice via TCP/IP, it damn well better sound the same and work on my fax machine. You know, there are differences here. So I don't have an answer. I'm thinking as I talk to you that maybe having a percentage that's reserved for neutral.
Yeah.
You know, and some rules that recognize these distinctions.
And there's also, you know, like technologies and like deep packet inspection.
Well, the technology is there to block. Right. China's blocked Skype.
Right. I mean,
I don't know how effective it is because I still get occasional people clicking on me and saying they want to talk to me and they're in China. It really surprises me, but I don't want to get into it because who knows what the Chinese government is doing.
Yeah.
They're worse than the NSA, right?
Right.
Maybe.
I have a hard time believing that, you know, like a large telecom company or anybody would outright block, you know, a competing service. But I do worry that they would impair or degrade the service just enough to make it not worth the consumer's while and do it in such a way so that the consumer doesn't really know that the impairment or degrading is actually taking place. Like if you can screw up every Xth packet to drop out of a voice over IP phone call, then the phone call quality is going to be not that great. If you can do it in such a way as to make it, well, what's the word I'm looking for here? Subtle
enough.
John,
I I don't believe for a minute that you can get away with that in a lot of cities without some geeks figuring it out.
I hope you're right.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, you can do, somebody could do some traffic tests between point A and B and find out.
Yeah.
You'd think. But, you know, I would think you're wrong.
I hope I'm wrong. I really do.
Well, they'll be found out, but that doesn't necessarily mean they can't do it.
Right.
And just, hey, you say that, I had heard that Comcast had blocked Vonage for a day.
Oh, really? I
hadn't
heard that.
It's just a rumor. I don't know. Somebody told me that. Well, assume it happened and they were testing something out and seeing if they could do it. And so people screamed. It's like the newspaper dropping a comic strip to see if it's really being noticed.
And, yeah.
And, okay, well, you know, they know how to do that. Are they going to do it yet? No, it's a hot topic right now. I don't want to tilt the playing field. But, yeah, they can do exactly what you're talking about later. Will they get found out? Oh, probably. So what? Later.